Good Monday morning. Hope your work day's off to a pretty good start so far. It is 10:06. Hi there, and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rakow with you until 12:30 this afternoon, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. Another edition of Science Files coming up for you this hour, and St. Mary's astrophysicist Rob Thacker is back with us this morning. I'll make the introduction in just a moment. Next hour, it's your turn to sound off. We'll go to the phones at 11 for our first open hour of the week. We call it Manic Monday, and of course, anything goes in our open hours. After the news at noon, about a third of Nova Scotia's households will be getting a survey in the mail this week from Engage Nova Scotia. And Engage Nova Scotia's Danny Graham will tell us more about that. And we'll hear another Halifax History Moment this afternoon with historian and author Mr. Blair Bead. 10:07, but this hour, it is time for Science Files. And joining me in the studio this morning, St. Mary's University astrophysicist, Dr. Rob Thacker. Dr. Rob, good morning to you.
Good morning.
All refreshed and ready to roar? And...
I would like to think so, after a few days away, back in Halifax. I have a ridiculously large number of emails to work through. So if anyone's working or waiting for an email from me, my sincere apologies. I will get to you probably by about Wednesday.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, a little backed up after a couple of days off.
That's right.
902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a question or a comment for Dr. Rob here this morning, give us a call. You can also send us a question via email, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a question. Our Twitter handle, @TheRickHowe Show. All right, where do we start here today? Let's start with this oceans thing. Hundreds of thousands of viruses in the oceans. And I printed off a copy here, and basically it suggests that there are something like over almost 200,000, count them, 200,000 different viral populations that live in our ocean waters.
One, two, three, four, five. I've got to be honest and say that I suspect there's a whole lot more than this as well. And so should you be concerned about this? Not really. There's a whole ton of biodiversity in the oceans, and looking at whether you consider viruses life is a whole separate conversation. But this is from the Tara Ocean Project, which basically went around sailing for 4 years, taking samples all around the Earth. And now they're finally publishing all of the research from this. I mean, there's going to be more, obviously, but this is going back to 2009, 2013. So this was done quite some time ago, and it's taken them that long to work through it. But I think what is amazing to me, and I don't really know the details, I should speak to a biologist about this, but they're saying that the viruses are actually adapted to the different levels of the ocean that they're in. And I don't know how a virus can adapt, because I've always presumed that viruses are literally just like this RNA. They're essentially in some kind of capsule to protect the molecule and so on. But at the end of the day, they don't have a lot of sophistication. So how exactly they're adapted, I don't know. I'd be really curious to know that.
Well, I would assume, as somebody says here, marine viruses were found on the ocean surface, all the way down to 4,000 meters deep.
All the way through the water column, apparently. So what are they doing there? Well, they're literally in some kind of symbiotic relationship with all of the other things that are there. So that's the life and so on. And so the other thing that people say is, well, what do viruses actually do? And so this has been something that perplexed us for a long time. But clearly viruses have a role to play in evolution as well. So they will inject their own DNA into us. And in many cases, if you look at the whole human genome, the estimates suggest that maybe 8 or 9% of that could be genetic material from viruses.
Really?
Right? Yeah. So they're not just this thing that's going out there and making us sick, killing us and things like that. They're also putting pieces of their genetic information into our DNA. So that kind of relationship isn't necessarily a bad thing. It can help in some way, I guess, in terms of developing different kinds of genetic adaptions and so on. Although there's an awful lot of the genome whose actual value we don't understand, it could be useless and so on. So this is nonetheless something to really think about, because we just don't know that much about the oceans. And here we go. So finding out that there's, 200,000 they identified, there must be way different, many more different ones. And if you actually count the number of viruses, it's got to be an astronomically large number.
Yeah, really, and it does say here that scientists are only beginning to understand just the role that these tiny microbes play. But they do believe that most are harmless to humans, but they're not sure yet of the impact on marine life.
Like I'm sure quite a lot of them aren't harmless to the marine life. Some of them probably do impact marine life. I think they break down viruses into two types, those that kind of cause harm and those that have some kind of symbiotic relationship, I think. But I can't remember the specific names of those. But yeah, I'm sure that some of these viruses will cause problems for fish, algae, and so on. Yep. And even viruses can cause problems for single cell bacteria as well. So that's always something to think about. They call them phages, I think. So yeah. But nonetheless, really amazing to think about all of the diversity in the oceans.
Yeah, really, yeah. Really. 10:12 is the time Mark emails to say, what would happen with our world if or when all of the polar ice caps melt? How do they also regulate heat?
Oh, so they have a significant impact on what's called the albedo of the Earth. And so albedo is the amount of sunlight that's reflected off the Earth. So if you reflect energy off the Earth and out into space, you kind of have a cooling effect. So if you lose the polar ice caps, you'll lose a significant amount of albedo from the Earth. So that's one of the concerns with the actual melting of the North Pole, is that as the ice actually starts to go away, and so you lose that kind of reflection,
yep,
then you actually put more heat into the water and you can speed up the melting as well. So there could be a bit of a feedback process going on there.
What's that impact on globally?
That means it's going to melt faster as it gets smaller. It's a little bit like if you have something like a ice cubes in a glass, yep, in the sun, sipping your Mai Tai, you do, right? When they're nice and big, right, they melt comparatively slowly. But once they get smaller, then they kind of melt quickly because everything is warming up around them.
And this will rise obviously level of the water.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to see sea level rise, not because of what's happening. Although there are differences between salt water and fresh water, but nonetheless, it's the ice in Antarctica that actually contributes most to sea level rise, because a lot of that is actually on land and just flowing out into the oceans. So if you melt the stuff on land, yep, and it flows out into the oceans, then you are naturally going to increase sea level as well.
And there are huge chunks of Antarctic ice that are breaking off and
melting. So we're seeing ice shelf collapses. I mean, we've been seeing ice shelf collapses for a long time. I mean, we've been seeing that for decades, but the rate at which things seem to break up is particularly disturbing. And a lot of that is related to the overall stability of the glaciers, because glaciers at the front of them kind of like going out onto the ocean, and there is a weak point at which the mass and the sort of like weight bearing of the glacier on the ocean, it kind of goes out from the land and then onto the ocean, and there's a weak point, and that can actually fracture and actually have the whole glacier just literally carve off and go out into the sea. So that's something to be concerned about.
And again, we're told that by, 2050, the entire Arctic could be ice-free during the summer months?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the whole sort of, they call it, unfortunately, the Arctic death spiral. And so that is the amount of ice cover you have as a function of the months in the year drawn in a circle. And so they've drawn it as you go towards the future, you create this spiral that's getting smaller and smaller and smaller in terms of the number or the area of the total ice. And so it's a real concern. And yes, we are potentially looking at summers without ice in the North Pole. And that is going to have a big impact on the overall ecosystem up there. Obviously, a lot more heat going into that, because there isn't a cap to cover up and reflect that sunlight back out into space. So it's going to have an impact on the oceans there.
And that's contributing to the increase in global temperatures as well, is it not?
But yes. I mean, one of the big things that we don't fully understand, well, we understand, I don't want to say we don't understand it, we understand a lot of the gross details, but how energy is transported through the oceans is a big part of understanding our overall climate system. And so we do have a good picture of that, but all of the details of that are actually quite complicated.
10:16 is the time. Here's Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files. We've got Tim and Brian on hold. We'll get to you in a moment. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob, give us a call at 902-405-6000. Or 1-877-801-8255. We're going to take a quick break. Then more with Science Files with Dr. Rob. We'll be back right after this. 10:19 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker with us here for Science Files. And Tim's on the line. He's got a question for us this morning. Morning, Tim.
Hi. My question is, some days you can look up in the nice blue sky and see the moon, and other days you can't. What's going on?
Yeah, that's a good question.
That's a great question. So the honest answer is that's all to do with the moon's position relative to the sun in the sky. So when we have a full moon, then the moon is actually as far away from the sun as it effectively can be on our sky. So that means that you get a full moon and it's overhead basically at midnight. Whereas other parts, when you have a new moon, you're actually really quite close to the sun on the sky. So you can't really see the moon very well because it's right up next to the sun and so on. And so whenever you have the moon that's sort of like halfway between those two points, then you will actually see the moon during the day at some point. And it's one of those things that as a kid, you look up and you see, hey, I can see the moon during the day. What's going on? And that happens all the time, right? Because it's just a question of where the moon is on its orbit and where it is relative to the sun.
It does seem rather strange, though. Look up in the noontime sky, and there's the moon sticking.
Yeah, no, I know, and it freaked me out when I was a kid because I was thought, you're the moon, you shouldn't be able. But it happens all the time, and it's literally just where it is on the sky relative to the sun, and that's changing as it goes around once a month. Basically.
All right, that's a good question, Brian. Good morning to you.
Morning. So, Dr. Rob, my question is: you were talking about this ocean rise and the melting of the ice caps and things. I was wondering how much of an effect, or if it would have an effect at all, if thermal expansion of the ocean as it warms up, would that have much of an effect on ocean rise?
Yes, it does have an effect. I can't remember exactly the precise amounts. I mean, I think that one of the reasons why people get very concerned about Antarctica and Greenland is just because there's so much fresh water in those places. And the other thing is to remember fresh water is slightly less dense. But yes, the heating of the ocean will have an impact. I wish I could give you a percentage number off the top of my head. I can't. But certainly, yes, as the sea level warms up, then it will have some kind of an impact on the overall volume, because as things warm up, they do tend to expand. Not everything tends to expand, but most things do. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Appreciate the call, David. Brian, rather, thank you very much. Let's go to Bob next here this morning. Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Good, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I wish that sun had sailed, though.
Well, it's here for a few days. I believe it's out till at least Friday when the clouds will start moving in again. So you got a few days of sunshine there, Bob.
Yeah. Oh, doctor, I want to ask, when are you going to have your wife back on?
Well, we haven't done the Saturday show for a number of years, so we haven't been able to do that for a while, I'm afraid.
On this show with Rick.
Oh, well, we could get Linda on, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Because my question, the understanding it. Anyways, we let's go ahead of time and say our technology finds a planet. It's 500 million light years away.
500 million?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it would take how long to get there with our technology advanced?
500 million times a very large number.
Yeah. It would be a long time, Bob. Yeah.
So basically, we would have to, we know there's life there. It's the same as Earth, and it's perfect. We want to get there. Our planet's dying. We build a great big spaceship, it would have to be, and then we would have to have families all the way there. If it took 500 years, let's say.
You've been watching too many science fiction movies again.
Okay, let's go, Rick.
What I'm getting at, why I ask this question, because I hear now the people that's been in space for quite a while, they're finding their bones are changing and everything.
Yep.
So we may leave here as we look today. But when we get there, we could be totally different looking creatures.
Okay, I know where you're going with this.
So
let me just respond to that. So this is a suggestion, which is actually quite a reasonable one, that as we go from one environment to another environment, we could see some kind of genetic adaptation taking place. And so the fundamental problem with that for us is that if it was, say, 500 million is basically another galaxy. Let's assume that we have a nearby star and it would take 10,000 years to travel there, right? So you can do the math on that. That's that's 10, about 100 generations, basically. Mm-hmm. So in 100 generations, how much genetic change would we see in humans? We could see some, but would we be completely different from what we are now? Probably not. But the bigger thing that you're bringing up, Bob, and that's what I would like to talk about, is the fact that we're not adapted for living in low gravity, and we have a number of issues with living in low gravity. So in all likelihood, if we did build these big sort of like, let's call them interstellar arcs for any other term, we would have to have some kind of gravity. Artificial gravity.
Yeah.
And so spinning them, whatever, we would have to do that. Yeah.
Well, that's great, and I'd love to have your wife on. I've got 12,500 questions.
Absolutely. I will let Linda know. And she's a very busy lady, but I'm sure she'd be happy to come on.
All right.
Hey, have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Bob. Take care. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255.
I'm going to tell Linda she's got a fan.
Well, there you go. and he was talking about, again, this was they compared the two identical twins who are astronauts. One had spent a year in space, and when they came back, they determined that there were some slight differences. They weren't really identical twins anymore, but he kind of...
No, no, that's this. Okay, so this is... I know why you said that, and a lot of people got very upset by this. So the way it's reported in the media was not entirely accurate. They said, oh, suddenly they're not identical twins anymore because there's changes in the gene expression. And gene expression is basically just how all of the things that your genetic material does actually gets done. Right. And so what they're basically saying is while Mark was up in space, he was behaving or his body was behaving in slightly different ways because his expression of all that genetic material and the proteins that it creates was being done in a slightly different way. Oh, sorry, Mark was on the ground, Scott was up in space, was done in a slightly different way to versus how things were operating down on the ground. And that's because of the differences primarily in the gravity environment. Fluids behave differently in low gravity compared to heavy gravity. And that seems to be a big part of what's going on there. So when he came down to the ground, though, over a period of about 6 to 8 months, then things started changing back to how they were. There were some small differences, but nothing really significant. And so this idea that his whole DNA changed and he was this different person was not accurate. It was basically how his body was operating was different and how it was expressing all of that genetic material was different. And so that changed, as I said, when he came back down to the ground.
But that does raise questions about a long time in space.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the big things that has been talked about recently is the fact that viruses can start expressing themselves. So one of the very common virus that many, many people have is herpes virus, right? So that's something gives you cold sores on your lips and so on. So that's something that a lot of people carry. You can even have it passed on to you during childbirth from your mother, basically. So that's a very common virus, but most of us have developed antibodies to it. And so we don't have significant flare-ups from it, except in very rare cases when you have a weakened immune system or something like that. But they found that in space, because of the fact that the lower gravity causes viruses to behave differently with cells and cells behave differently with fluids, they found that remarkably up to 50% of the astronauts who had herpes started expressing the virus and shedding the virus again.
Really?
Right, even though they have all the antibodies. So that was something that's been a little bit of a surprise. It's not too big a deal because it's just herpes and herpes does go away. But nonetheless, this is showing that you go into a zero gravity environment and your immune system can respond in different ways.
So obviously there's things we haven't yet learned about.
Oh, there is a lot to learn here. I mean, I did a call-in show about this. And so we're learning a lot about the human immune system just by doing experiments in space.
Wow. Right? Yeah.
So seriously, I mean, people say, well, why should we go to space? Well, I mean, we're learning a lot about the human body. Right. That's a really useful thing to know.
10:28 is the time. David, stay there. We'll get to after a news update. This is Science Files this Monday morning with Dr. Rob Thacker with us here in the studio till 11 o'clock. And if you've got a question for us, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll take a quick break for a news update right now. Then back with more Science Files with Dr. Rob. We're back right after the news. 10:33 here on a Monday morning. Science Files this hour with Dr. Rob Thacker. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255, just like David has done here this morning. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Rick. Dr. Thacker.
Good morning.
Dr. Thacker, you mentioned a lady at SMU who could answer my question in more detail about the periodic table. My problem is I don't have email. I'm a dinosaur.
Okay.
You are.
I didn't have internet connection or an iPhone, smartphone, whatever you call them.
So, okay. So, David, you live in a cave, do you?
Pretty well.
sorry.
Well, we do have telephones.
Yes. Would there be a number I could call?
Hold on a second.
What is it you want to know, David?
I wanted to know if there are stable and non-stable corresponding elements.
Well, so there's no sort of like direct correspondence. I can tell you that, right? So there are just elements that are very stable and elements that are very unstable. There's no sort of like connection between the two of them. It's just all down to the nuclear physics of how that works out.
Like I said with Dr. What's his name? Sheldon on Big Bang Theory said the lightest element on Earth with an unstable isotope is technetium. I thought it was helium or hydrogen.
I would have thought that you could actually have very loosely bound states of helium or hydrogen that would be unstable, but I don't know for sure. So.
Right.
So you want your person at St. Barry's then, basically?
Yes, please.
Okay, right. So hold on a second, then I'm trying to find you a phone number. I know what I need to do. Oh, gosh.
Well, David, we'll put you on hold.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
And when we get a number, I'll get Katie to pass it on to you, okay?
Please. Thank you very much.
You stand by right there. 902-405-6000 or 1-877.
Got it.
All right.
Okay.
Hang on. Let's get David back here again. David, you're back already here. Here we go.
Okay, here we go. So 902.
Yes.
420.
420.
5428.
5428. And her name is?
Ritu Kanungo.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Dr. Kanungo.
Kanungo.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. No problem.
Thanks, David. Good luck with the effort. Let's go to Ken on the line here now. Morning, Ken.
Morning, guys. How are you?
We're doing well,
good, thanks.
Thank you.
How are you?
Good. Listen, well, I have a question. On the internet, there's a lot of noise around the solar minimum and the Maunder minimum and how it's going to impact ice. You know, we're going to get a mini ice age and all this. Do you have any comments about how the sun is going through its cycle? And could it be that climate change is related to solar emission? Versus
I know exactly what you're talking about. So the honest answer is that, yes, there is natural variability in the sun. But that level of variability can be actually really compared to the variations you'll get in the overall heating from things like additional CO2, increasing the greenhouse effect and so on. And so people who run the climate models have actually done this. And there is a beautiful paper that actually separates out the overall impact of variations in the sun versus variations in heating from increases in CO2. And you can see that while there is a small variation that comes from changes in the overall warming from the sun, in fact, the increase in heating that comes from increased CO2 over the last 100 years really more than swamps that signal from changes in the overall solar, what do you call it, insulation. Right. Which sounds like insulation, but it's insolation. So the short answer is yes, people who do this modeling do take into account changes in the overall luminosity of the sun, but it's a smaller impact on overall surface temperature than you actually get from increases in CO2.
Okay, because there's a lot of talk about the Maunder minimum.
Yeah.
That caused the ice age in 1700, and are we going back there? And there's a lot of noise around it.
I know. And so it's actually very frustrating for the people who work in the area, because this is one of the first things they looked at when they had the sophisticated climate models. And you don't even need a sophisticated one for this, because you can actually just do this on a very sort of like what we would call a single cell analysis for the model. And so people have done this. There have been many papers written about this. It's all drawn up, and yet this continues to be a thing that people talk about, because people want to believe other things. People want to believe it's an external factor. It's not us causing it. I totally understand why that is. I would love CO2 not to have an impact on the climate, but unfortunately it does.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Okay. Appreciate the call, Ken. Thanks very much. 10:38 is the time. Looking here at another story, one of the notes you gave me, all new cars in Europe to be fitted with speed limiters.
Yeah.
And I'm just reading here this change will be introduced in 2022. All new cars in Europe will be fitted with speed limiters and other mandatory safety devices after it was approved by the European Transport Safety Council. Mm-hmm. According to a report, new cars would be fitted with a system called Intelligent Speed Assistance, which will use GPS data and traffic sign recognition systems to limit the car's engine power and with it, the car's speed. And as someone who likes to travel just a little bit above the speed limit, I'm alarmed by this, Doctor.
I know, and I can understand why people would be. So there's a couple of things to bear in mind. Actually, limiting people's speed to the speed limit is a safety hazard in itself, right? So you can switch it off.
Yes.
Right?
It says here the system can be overridden by a sharp push on the throttle. However, unlike speed limiters we have at the moment, if the driver continues to drive above the speed limit for several seconds, it'll keep telling you.
So I think that's perfectly reasonable. That's basically like the flashing, your speed is blah, 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 but it's there constantly. So
this is not a governor then, as we understand a governor.
No, okay. Although Volvo has announced that it will be putting governors to limit the top speed of its cars, right? So they will be limiting the top speed of their cars to, I think it's 180 kilometers an hour, which just, still is pretty quick.
It is,
right? But no, I actually, I think most people know that one of the biggest issues with safety on the road is obviously
speed
and drunk driving. Yeah. But this could potentially say they're estimating as many as 25,000 lives within 15 years. There's 40,000 people killed a year due to road accidents in the U.S. And we kind of accept that at some level, right? And drunk driving we don't accept, and we obviously have massive campaigns to try and stop that. But there's this overall sort of like feeling that, roads are hazardous, but a lot of this is human error, unfortunately. And that is something that we can eliminate or help certainly reduce, right? Especially with self-driving cars. I mean, yes, there will still probably be failures, there will still probably be accidents at some level, but the human element of it being taken out only can improve safety at some level. That's assuming, of course, that the engineering of all the self-driving cars is done appropriately and so on.
Volvo's chief executive and president says, while a speed limitation is not a cure-all, it's worth doing, he says, if we can even save one life. So this is all about, again, saving lives.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, so unfortunately, cars are inherently dangerous. I mean, just think about it. You've got something traveling along at dozens of kilometers an hour, right? And there's a human behind the wheel, right?
Yeah.
What if you don't see that person stepping out? I mean, you can always argue that there are dangers from pedestrians and so on, but but you've got to be aware when you're behind the wheel, and you can be distracted, you can be dealing with kids in the car and so on, and that's not your fault, that's just the situation as it presents to you. And so you have to try and make these things safer, unfortunately.
Yeah. I'm sure this will go over okay in Europe. I'm not sure how North Americans will react to something like this.
Seatbelts.
Yeah, I guess. Right. And as well, this mandatory speed limiter will come with a number of other compulsory safety tech features, including data loggers. Not exactly sure what that is. Autonomous emergency braking systems. And I believe that's an improvement.
Yeah, I mean, there are some cars that have that already in some cases. Yeah.
Lane keep assist, driver fatigue detection systems. Yeah. Another good point as well here. But I don't know, this speed limit.
I mean, this is literally the big computer watching you. I don't know. I mean, so the incredible thing for me was going and being in Florida and see people on motorcycles without helmets.
Truly.
And I'm like, you're crazy. You're absolutely nuts. I mean, as safe as you can be, all it takes is someone else hitting you, the other person, and then you are toast.
Yep. Right. So you're right. 2020 is when this change will take place in Europe, and it'll limit the top speed of cars to 112 miles per hour, 180 kilometers an hour.
I mean, so there's going to be a bunch of Germans who are probably pretty unhappy about that because the autobahns, right?
I never thought of that.
Yeah.
So, do they still have no speed limit on those major
there
highways?
There are some parts of the autobahns as far as I'm aware, but I don't know. I haven't been to Germany to find out.
Yeah, I remember the last time I was there would be 1970.
Yeah.
And I remember going down the autobahn in a Mercedes, in fact, at about 150 kilometers an hour, and only to see a little Volkswagen Beetle blow by us with its police emergency signs. It had the police use little Volkswagen Beetles with Porsche engines in them.
There's a thing in Europe where actually, funnily enough, people have mentioned my wife, so I will mention my wife on the air. So There's a thing in Europe of putting really powerful engines
in little small cars.
In little small cars or saloon cars and so on. And so there was a famous Vauxhall, which was an arm of GM, Lotus Carlton, which had a Lotus engine in a Carlton saloon car. And you didn't know, if you didn't know how fast this thing could go, it was a real shock when someone put their foot down.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So my wife was like, that's what I want.
Me too. 10:44 is our time. He is Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files, and we'll take another quick break, and we'll be back with more right after this. 10:47, Monday morning, Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker. Here's another headline. Plant-based eating goes mainstream as Beyond Meat targets Canadian grocery shelves. This is this burger that's not a meat burger, and I refuse to call it a burger.
Call it a burger. It's whether you call it a beef burger or not, I guess.
Yeah,
or a hamburger,
I guess. Okay. So. This is a Beyond Meat, they call it. This is, again, it's getting more and more popular as people turn away from meat and this whole climate change and the methane and the cows and such. Tell us what this is all about.
Right. So this is something. So people are probably aware, like you have veggie burgers and so on. And, and there are a lot of really delicious veggie burgers out there. I'm going to say that. So my wife and I, we make some at the beginning of the barbecue season. And then we have the store of them in our. That's not an invitation for everyone to come over for barbecue.
Okay,
sorry.
Good. Well.
But anyway, so people have been trying for many years to come up with a way of taking the protein that's vegetable based and then turning that into something that has the same kind of texture and flavor as meat protein.
Yeah.
And so there are a number of companies working on this. In fact, we've talked a little bit about this in the past, and a lot of venture capital go in this. But Beyond Meat is probably the biggest name right now, and they have something called the Beyond Burger. So this was being sold at A&W.
Yeah.
And now they are actually launching this in some Canadian grocery stores. So I don't know. I looked yesterday. It's not in Superstore. I don't know if it's in Sobeys or not.
Now, Katie just saying it's at Sobeys.
It's at Sobeys. Yeah. So there we go. Yeah. So this is something that some people have reviewed it and said it smells a bit like dog food, right?
Okay.
But I don't know. I haven't been able to try it. So I'm going to go to Sobeys and try one. So, and I'm interested to see where this goes because the marketing has been quite smart that people are, there are some people who are turned off by the term veggie burger, right? And so this is a plant-based burger. That's how it's being sold. It's not being sold specifically as a veggie burger. And so from what I've heard from people who've had them, they've said generally they are actually quite good.
And they taste just like a real burger almost.
Pretty close was what my friend said. I'm sure there'll be people call in and tell us what they thought of
it. But you've never had one.
I haven't, no.
Katie, have you eaten one of these?
Yes, from A&W.
All right. Katie,
what was your opinion?
Tell us about it.
I liked it. You know, I've ate veggie burgers from Harvey's. I've had the Yves ones that you can get at the superstore. And this is definitely one of the better ones.
Okay. Yeah.
So there we go. So the big thing in this story is they are coming to the Canadian market and they're trying to get a foothold. And so the question is going to be, how successful can they actually be? Because obviously there are a lot of massive food conglomerates who are going to want to get into this space. I mean, the interest in this type of burger has been growing significantly. People are estimating that the market for it has doubled since 2013, right? So if there is consistently more interest in plant-based alternatives to beef burgers, we'll see what happens. And of course, on the other side, there is a very large amount of money behind making hamburgers, the regular hamburgers as well. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes in general. I think the estimate for Canada's fast food industry is something like $20 billion a year or something like that, which sounds low to me, to be honest. But anyway.
George just emailed, say, is it twice the price of regular?
I don't know what the pricing is. That is a good question. I'm pretty sure it's not going to be cheap. Because there's a fair amount of processing that goes into making it. But people will be prepared to pay. I'd also like to see an end-to-end energy analysis as well of this and see how much energy it takes to actually make these things. But nonetheless, this is a thing now, and we're going to see more companies trying to move into this space. It's not technologically simple to do. It's taking a fair amount of effort. And if you look at the ingredients, I wouldn't say all of the ingredients are necessarily what you would like to see in a burger. I think there's coconut fat in there or something.
I would imagine a lot of chemicals too, would there not?
I don't know. They're not going to try and use too many different preservatives and so on, but I don't know. I'm not going to speculate. So
jury is still out, I guess.
So we'll see. So I'm going to try and find some and try some, and then maybe we can have Linda on and we can both talk about
there
what we
go.
Thought about them.
There you
yeah.
go. Okay. So. Jared just emailed a question asking if I would ask Dr. Rob, if there's no gravity in space, how does a black hole have so much gravity? If a black hole draws in everything around it, is space expanding faster than the black holes are drawing space in? And if not, will Earth eventually be sucked in here?
Okay. So I understand where this question is coming from, because it can be a little bit confusing. So there is gravity in space, right? If you took an astronaut and stopped them from orbiting and just put them at 200 miles up, they'll fall back down. So there is gravity up there. The reason why things seem weightless in space is not because you are so far away from the Earth that there's no gravity. It's because you're actually falling around the Earth in the gravitational field, but you're moving forward to take into account how much you're falling down. So that's literally what's happening when you're orbiting. You're literally falling down around the curvature of the Earth when you orbit.
Okay.
And so because of that, because you are falling down constantly, you don't feel any gravity.
There you go.
So that's what's going on. So the answer is, yes, if a black hole is out there, it's got its own gravity. It's literally attracting things the same way the sun attracts things, the same way the Earth attracts things.
Interesting. Okay. Deborah just emailed, just to say, so you know, she writes, that although the Beyond Meat burger is supposed to be vegetarian, it is cooked, Katie, on the same grill as the regular burger, so it does come in contact with animal fats.
That's a good thing to know.
Yeah,
okay.
Indeed.
Interesting.
Doug's giving us a call this morning. Hi, Doug.
How you doing this morning?
Good, sir. How are
good,
you doing?
Thanks.
Good. I just want to have a couple questions here, and I'll hang up and listen to what the answers would be. First of all, what are the CO2 levels now, and how do you take these measurements, and how often are these measurements taken? And are they uniform or consistent around the globe? Like, is it if it's 4.2 here, is it 4.2 all around the globe? And do they move around with the winds that are up there and stuff like that? Thank you.
All right. Appreciate that, Doug.
Okay. I'm not going to address all of those questions because I'm not a climate scientist, and those should be addressed by a professional climate scientist.
Sure enough.
What I will say is, in terms of how gases do mix very evenly. If you have a particular source in a certain area, then it will take time for that to mix. But by and large, if you take, for example, if we're in this room and you look at the overall level of gas mixtures in this room, it's actually going to be really quite even, right? So as long as you don't have a particular source that's pumping something out and it hasn't had time to mix, then overall the different levels of gases will actually be fairly even.
Okay.
Okay.
Harvey just emailed to say some Acura TL models have a governor that limits speed to 150 miles per hour, he writes, which is, what, over 200K, isn't it?
Freaking
that's not
quick.
A governor.
I don't know if I've ever driven a car at that speed.
And another headline that you've given me here this morning for some chat, new Hubble measurements confirm universe is expanding faster than expected. So the universe is constantly growing, basically. Is that what it's saying?
So there is this huge debate in professional circles whether we should use that terminology or not. But because it makes you wonder, what's it growing into?
Well, yeah,
right?
Really.
And so the honest answer is that this is not growing into anything, but the space between things is getting bigger. And so that always kind of blows people's heads and minds, because you're like, but if something gets bigger, it gets bigger into something. But the honest answer is that's because the universe is the point at which that stops. Right, there's nothing outside the universe. And it could be that the universe is a closed geometry anyway, so you go off in one direction, you come back to the same point. And in that case, there's nothing for it to expand into anyway, right? So it is a challenge, but where this particular story, or why this particular story is really interesting, is because we now have a little bit of tension between the measurements of the expansion at different points of the age of the universe. And so that's calling into question whether there are some other things perhaps going on that are changing the way the universe is expanding. And so the rate at which the universe expands is dependent upon the overall amount of energy in the universe. And there could be, possibly, some kind of additional physics going on, a fairly small effect. It's not a huge effect, but a fairly small effect that's changing the overall expansion properties of the universe. And so there's a fairly big conference about this at the beginning of the month, actually. That's where these results were reported. And so people are looking at doing better and better measurements and trying to pin this down. The interesting thing is it's one of those situations where we may be able to measure it really well, but we won't necessarily know what's causing the issue for some time. So this is something that's got people who do particle physics, because they're all like, ooh, this could be some kind of like subatomic particle that's making this happen. They're very excited about it. But the astronomers, we just want to make the measurements and figure out precisely where this difference is coming from as we change the era in which we measure the Hubble constant. So there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in astronomy.
But did you say the universe has an end, has a limit? That there is an
end? We don't know, because all we can see is actually out to the edge of the observable universe.
Yeah.
And because the universe appears to have a finite age of about 13.7 billion years, light can only travel so far in that time. So there's only so far you can actually see out. I mean, that's a simple way of putting it. It's actually slightly more complicated than that, but it doesn't matter. That's good enough, right? And so there's only so far you can see. And if you say, what's beyond that? I go, I don't know. I really don't know, because we can't know. And so people will say, well, how will we know if the universe is infinite? We can never know if the universe is infinite, right? Because you literally can't wait an infinite amount of time to get the signal from the other side.
Yeah.
Right?
Fascinating.
Brain blown.
Yeah, all of that stuff. Dr. Rob, your hours are always fascinating. Thank you very much. Fascinating and educational as well here this morning. I think we learned a lot here today.
That was a lot of fun. Thanks very much.
It was indeed. Dr. Rob Thacker in Science Files, and he'll be back with us again next Monday for another edition. It is now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update coming up at the top of the hour. And then it's your turn to sound off this morning. Time for Manic Monday coming up after the news, and our phone lines await your calls. Right now at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got something to say this morning, I'd love to hear from you. We'll take your calls after the news, and the news is coming up next.